This is Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate one last time at WNYC and WNYC.org. And I've been looking forward to my next guest all week, I've got to say. For many baseball fans, the 1951 season was defined by a single moment, the shot heard round the world, the home run hit by Bobby Thompson of the Giants off Ralph Branca of the Brooklyn Dodgers, which secured the pennant for the Giants and labeled Mr. Branca, well, the GOAT, in the minds of some Dodger fans. I won't say all Dodger fans, because he's also a hero for anyone who really keeps track of things. In his new memoir, A Moment in Time, he reveals some surprising truths about his career and talks a lot about that faithful game. And the book, written with David Ritz, is published by Scribner, and I'm pleased that it brings Ralph Branca to the Leonard Lopate Show today.
Thank you, Andy.
Now, Ralph, I've got to say, this is something that really bugs. I'm a huge sports fan. I love baseball. My son is a huge Yankee fan. I don't know how you feel about that.
Remember, you don't know, but I was a Yankee for 2.5 months.
I don't think of you as Yankee, Ralph Branca.
No, I don't either.
Yeah, there's some Yankees that come to mind before Ralph Branca, I've got to say.
Not too many.
Not too many. But I, you know, I... one thing that bothers me about sports fans, and I am one, is that, you know, you go to a game like a Yankee game, for example, and you're seeing some of the greatest athletes in the world, and there's some loser sitting behind you who's cussing out A-Rod or Derek Jeter, one of these great, even Mariano, one of these great physical specimens, when they do the slightest thing wrong, as if the guy behind me could do better. Does that bother you at all, or do you just think, well, that comes with the territory?
No. My reflection is some guy had a bad night, has a hangover, or the baby was up all night. So he gets to the office, and what does he do? He shuffles papers, but nobody sees him.
That's
he
right.
Shuffles papers. He sharpens his pencils 3 times. But a ball plays out in the open, and in baseball, you know who made the goof. Football, nobody knows which lineman missed the block or a back missed a block that screwed up the play. So
that's
baseball
right.
is a wide-open game where, and everybody's played some form of baseball, whether it's kickball, punch ball, kick the can, stick ball. So male or female, they've played some form of baseball. So they have some knowledge about baseball, but it's wide open and you can tell who made the mistake.
Right. In football, it's if the quarterback, you know, doesn't, or somebody drops a pass, then all the attention's on them. But you're right, if you're the left tackle or something, no one really knows what your job is anyway.
And the other thing is, the quarterback throws a ball and it skips off the receiver's hands and it's intercepted. Who gets the blame? The quarterback.
That's right. So you're sort of relating to the quarterback in that situation.
Right. So,
yeah, who gets
you know,
the blame?
As you say, yeah, I'm the quarterback in this situation, 1951. But, you know, I didn't lose a pennant.
No, of course not. Well, we're going to, you know, you've been asked questions about that game and that pitch forever and ever, and we are going to do that. We'll do that later in the interview. We'll relive it one more time, and you relive it in your book, so it's fair game. You're getting into it. But as you said, you know, I didn't know you were a Yankee. There's a whole lot about your career that people don't know. Tell me a little bit about your childhood. You came from a huge family.
Absolutely. I'm number 15 out of 17.
My gosh.
I go, thank God they didn't invent television in the 20s, or I probably wouldn't be here.
Touche. This is kind of interesting. It was interesting to me, certainly. You grew up Catholic, but you discovered later in life that your mother was Jewish? Is that true?
Yeah, I just discovered it.
How did that come? Ancestry.com? How did you learn that?
No. A guy named Joshua Prager. Mm-hmm. Joshua wrote a book, 2006, about 5 years ago, called The Echoing Green. And Josh does vast investigations about it, you know. I mean, he really works at getting details. And so he found a friend who was in Budapest, and somewhere, some way, he asked me once if I was Jewish. I said, no, I'm Catholic. How about your mother? I said, she went to church, you know. Whenever, you know, first of all, she was too busy when there was 10 kids at home and
right.
and three, my grandfather, my mother and father. She was too busy working. But then once the family was empty, there was only the last four boys at home, she went to Mass religiously. So I grew up being a Catholic. And he discovered, you know, somewhere, that my mother might be Jewish. So he had a friend of his in Budapest go to my mother's hometown, Sandorf, which is 60 miles from Budapest. And he looked it up and found out that my mother was born Jewish. She's the eldest of eight children. And so in the Jewish religion, which I'm now one.
Right.
Is that
Mazel Tov, by the way, now, as we say.
Mazel Tov. Now, I have to say, how do you say thank you?
I'm not that advanced. I wasn't even bar mitzvah. I'm just sort of faking it. But anyway, you know.
I know L'chaim and Shalom.
L'chaim. So. That's right. We both saw Fiddler on the Roof. That's excellent.
Right.
What age were you when you discovered that you were Jewish? I don't mean to harp on this, but it's fascinating.
No, just recently. It came out, I think Josh told me about June, that my mother's born Jewish, and she came to this country, and she wrote back home to her mother and father that she was going to marry a Catholic. He said, okay, and they said, okay. So my father was Catholic. Mm-hmm. They married, and every child she had was baptized, confirmed, First Communion, went to church. So we all grew up Catholic.
Well, you know, speaking as a Jewish baseball fan, it would have been so great to know at the time that you were Jewish, because we absolutely cherish our Jewish ballplayers. There aren't that many of them. You know, we had Sean Green a few years ago for the Dodgers, and that was a big deal. And
with that name like Sean, I didn't suspect it. but truthfully, I forget who it was. Maybe it was Don Rickles said, now we're going to get blamed for losing a pen in 1951 because Frank is Jewish.
Hank Greenberg, I'm reminded. You know, in Cleveland.
Sandy Koufax. Oh, don't forget Koufax.
No one will ever forget. Sandy Koufax, the most observant Jewish baseball player ever. Growing up in Cleveland, I was a Cleveland Indians fan, of course, which is, I guess, a kind of, oh, I don't know, martyrdom, really. I mean, it's hard to be an Indians fan these days. But growing up.
Wait a minute, don't forget the Cubs.
The Cubs, too. Okay. I know. You can't forget the Cubs. But we had a ball player named John Lowenstein who played for the Indians. And this being Cleveland and being before politically correct times, when he would get up to bat, they would actually play If I Were a Rich Man from Fiddler on the Roof.
Oh, really?
In Cleveland Municipal Stadium. And then somebody, I believe John Lowenstein, pointed out that he was not, in fact, Jewish. He was German. So that was really wholly inappropriate. But for a moment there, I was very excited to have a Jewish baseball player.
Well, remember you had Al Rosen.
Al Rosen was great. Al Rosen, Hank Greenberg, Koufax, Sean Green, and now Ralph Branca. So now you tried out for all the New York teams when you were a kid?
Well, I tried to try out. But when I went to the Polo Grounds for Giant Tryout, it rained. So they had like 150 tryouts of boys trying to make the team each day. So when we went on a Tuesday, there was 300 guys trying to try out. My brother, John, who was a year and a half older, was really the star pitcher of the team. Mm-hmm. And he was a very, very good pitcher. Well, he threw, and I was getting ready to throw next, and they closed the tryouts. And so
What happens when you're in a big family. Somebody else always gets your turn, you know.
No. I mean, I couldn't wear anybody else's wear-outs, you know, wear-me-downs, because I was too big. But I never tried out there. And then I went to Yankee Stadium, and they liked me. You know, I was 16, a skinny kid. I weighed like 6'2", maybe 2 1/4, weighed about 150. But I threw pretty hard. And the Chief Bender said, how old are you? I said, 16. He said, you're too young. We'll get in touch with you next year. Well, they didn't get in touch with they. It's in a card in Yankee Stadium where get in touch with them next year. And then I went way out to Sheepshead Bay and got off the last stop and went to Celtic Oval. And I threw, and they liked me. And so they asked me to throw batting practice. Well, 16-year-old kid, I got a little bit of a swelled head that I'm throwing batting practice. So that's how the Dodgers, they stayed on my butt and really followed me and signed me the next year.
This is Andy Borowitz. I'm in for Leonard Lopate at WNYC and WNYC, and I'm talking to Ralph Branca. And if you don't know who Ralph Branca is, my friend, you have not lived. Ralph Branca, one of the most legendary baseball players of all time, and a Brooklyn Dodger. I don't care. This Yankee business, I don't know. That's news to me. The Yankee thing is as big a shock as the Jewish thing was to you, I think. I always think of you as a Dodger. Now you were signed by Branch Rickey. What was he like? He's another one of these kind of towering figures in baseball.
He was a powerful man, you know. He was the general manager. And actually, there were two scouts who were principal. The principal reason I saw them, because they followed me. And when high school ended in June, they were right there to have me go down to Dodger office on Montague Street. Mm-hmm. And I had to bring my mother because I was only 17. Mm. So we went in there, and I ended up signing with the Dodgers. And, you know, once you sign with a team in those days, you were probably that team for the rest of your life. So I signed with the Dodgers, played for Olean, New York, in the Pony League, Pennsylvania, Ontario, New York. And I made $90 a month. So, and the next year, I went to NYU, played basketball and baseball. And then when the coach asked me about it, I had to tell him I was signed. So I ended up signing with the Dodgers at 18 in June 6th of 1944.
Mm-hmm. And how long were you playing in the minors before you
were brought
up?
2 months at Olean. And then I went to NYU, which mm-hmm. even though I was a professional, you know, I went and played baseball for NYU and basketball. And so I really only had 2 months in the minor league. Then I went to Brooklyn and stayed there about 2 months, June, July, and August I went to Montreal for a month. And the following year went a half a year to St. Paul from say, middle of April to the middle of July. And then I came back to the Dodgers.
Now, these were the days before there was a baseball union, and you didn't have, Scott Boras negotiating your contract. There weren't, you know, these big sports agents. You didn't have CAA in your corner. Were you 17 years old? Were you negotiating your own deal, or you just signed on the dotted line?
I was so anxious to play, and I thought that I would be drafted. My birthday's in January. I've been 18 January 44. So I said I want to play ball before I go into service. Mm-hmm. So I actually doubled up in high school to get out in June. Mm-hmm. And signed, no, I was too anxious to play. No negotiation, just give me the opportunity.
And there wasn't really much negotiation with a guy like Branch Rickey, right?
No. Well, no, because, you know, in 1945, you know, I came back from St. Paul and pitched very effectively. You know, 19 years old, and I started 15 games from say, July 20th, and I completed seven of them, had a 3.04 ERA. You know, I gave up 80 hits, walked 80 guys, and struck out 80 guys, very consistent. And I was making $3,300, $600 a month. And I wanted $6,000, and Ricky said, no young player your age bracket is making that kind of money. Now, I'm 20 years old, 1946. I had no answer. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't put an old head on a young body. So, unfortunately, I wish I would have said to him, nobody in my age bracket is as good as me. I wasn't a braggart, so.
Well, if you were playing now, you'd be getting paid a fortune because you could actually get people out, which is an unusual skill to have. Do you look at the way baseball is played now? First of all, the salaries must kind of blow your mind, and they're sort of in another planet. But does that?
No, salaries don't blow my mind mm-hmm. because. Obviously, because of television and radio,
right. There's
they
more
make
revenue.
So much, so much more money, and that they can give it to the players. You know, guys making 18, 19 million a year, 30 million a year. That doesn't blow my mind because obviously nobody puts a gun to the owners' heads
right.
and says, "Here, sign them for this amount." But the Scott Boras of this world,
right.
He's tough, but you know he'd be tough to work with. But I'd have my number if I was a GM. I'd have my number, and this is it. Take it or leave it, you know. And you got to take a fair number because, you know, free agency puts the onus on the GM that if the guy leaves, he's going to go with another club and maybe your opposition.
You know, we're going to later on obviously talk about the big moment. You contributed to one of the biggest, most memorable moments in sports history. But there's so many other high points of your career. I mean, you played in World Series. You had so many great games. What are some of the moments besides the one that everyone always seems to want to talk about, and you talk about in your book, what are the moments that you feel define your career, the things that you're happiest about when you look back on them?
Well, when I look back, like, the defining moment for me was in 1946. I hadn't pitched a whole lot. You know, Charlie Dressen had me not in the doghouse, but under it. You know, I only got 10 starts, and I ended up winning 3 games. But the 3 games I won were playing the Cardinals, mid-September, September 14th, And I was supposed to pitch to one man, and they were going to bring the little left-handed pitcher named Vic Lombardi. So the Cardinals had their lineup loaded with left-handers. Well, the first inning, you know, I was warming up going, sacrificial lamb, my butt, you know. So I got him out on five pitches, and Leo said, I'm keeping you in, kid. Keep throwing like that. Well, I pitched a three-hit shutout. The next game, I pitched another shutout. So I won three games in 46. Now, I must have done something wonderful over the winter because the next year I won 21.
Yeah, and almost no one does that anymore.
No.
Yeah.
Dwight Gooden did it, you know, 37 years later. He was a couple months younger than I was. But, you know, realistically, if Charlie had pitched me like he should have, 30 starts, I know he would have won at least 12 or 15 games. And we tied for the pennant. And guess who started the first playoff game in history at 20 years old?
Would that be?
Ralph.
Ralph Branca.
T. Branca.
Right.
I'm still the youngest guy to ever pitch a postseason game.
And I would say the youngest Jewish guy to do that as well.
Yeah, well, yeah, but you struck out, which was very, very bad.
Now, what about, before we go to the news, because we're going to come back and do much, much more, can you just say a few things about what it was like to play with Jackie Robinson? Because did you, you know, that was part of your life as well.
Yeah, well, when Jackie came up, you know, and I knew he had a great year at Montreal the previous year, and it was very tough on Jackie, you know. He had to execute. He had to play well. He was playing a strange position, first base. Mm-hmm. And he did it so well. I mean, he hit 297 as a rookie, which is pretty darn good. He led the league in stolen bases. He played first base, you know, defensively fine. But he was such a great competitor. You know, he would bunt, he'd steal a base, he'd get the pitcher upset because he jiggled around on the bases, you know, like he was going to go. So he was a vital part of why we won. I mean, he did his share, but, you know, under adverse conditions, because there was pressure on him to perform. Because if he flopped, it might have been, I'm going to say, a bad mark against All Blacks. But he flopped, mm-hmm. He couldn't play, and he was the first guy doing it.
And instead, he opened a lot of doors.
He opened a lot of doors, not only in baseball, but for the country.
Of course.
And for the world. So he was a big moment. And I say he did more for the black race than Martin Luther King. Because he was first.
Well, that's one assessment. I'm speaking with Ralph Branca about his career, what it was like to pitch during the dramatic 1951 pennant and playing during baseball's golden age. His memoir, A Moment in Time, An American Story of Baseball Heartbreak and Grace, is published by Scribner. It's Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate. We're going to have more with Ralph Branca after the news.
Third, not taking any chance. Watson without too big of a lead at second, but he'll be running like the wind if Thompson hits one. Branca throws. There's a long pass. It's going to be, I believe. The Giants won the pennant. Bobby Thompson hits into the lower deck of the left field stand. The Giants won the pennant, and they're going crazy. They're going crazy.
This is Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate here at WNYC and WNYC.org, and I'm here with legendary giant Ralph, giant. Let's see what I've done. Brooklyn Dodger. You played for too many baseball teams.
Don't get excited.
Well, the Giants did win the pennant. Brooklyn Dodger, Ralph Branca, and we're talking about his new book, his memoir, A Moment in Time, which is he wrote with David Ritz, coming out from Scribner. And first of all, I asked you before the break, I said, do you ever get sick of hearing that clip? Because I think I've heard that clip maybe. That's one of the most famous, other than like the Hindenburg, that's one of the most famous clips ever. And you had an interesting response to that. It doesn't bother you. How come it doesn't bother you?
Doesn't bother me. I mean, it doesn't bother me because the Giants, we should never had a playoff.
Right.
The Giants stole
You were way ahead of the Giants, right?
Yeah, we were 13 and a half games ahead of them, like on August 10th. and they swept us in the Polo Grounds. That's when they started stealing the signs. They came home from a Western trip and won 16 straight games, and that lead went from 13.5 down to like 5.5.
And now, wait, you slipped a little something in there. You said when they started stealing the signs. What? That's what we call in journalism burying the lead. That's a big deal. What do you mean they started stealing the signs?
Well, it's been documented.
Yes.
Joshua Prager wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal on January 31st, 2001, where he talked to giant players and said, I think he kind of contrived a way to get it out of them, that they all admitted that they stole the signs. Mm-hmm. And even Thompson, he said he was sitting in Thompson's home, and Thompson was on the couch and had a bat between his legs. He said, when I asked him, did you have the sign in that pitch? And he said, Thompson looked at the bat, looked at the fireplace, looked at the bat, and looked at him. He said, well, if I have to give you an answer, it's no. That's a very unusual way of saying yes.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you later became good friends with Bobby Thompson, right?
Well, you know, now, I had known about it. And, you know, people say you never really talked about it. But I was traded from the Dodgers to Detroit in 1953. Mm-hmm. And I played there for about a year to 54. And I roomed with Teddy Gray. He was a left-handed pitcher. And we roomed together, and we locked it together. His locker was just to the left of mine. So about almost a year with Detroit, I think it was like the end of May. I went to them like in June. He said, I have to tell you something. He said, I was sworn not to talk about it, but I have to tell you. He said, we're good friends, and I have to tell you. And then he went on and talked how the Giants started stealing the signs. I said, where'd you learn this? He said, from a guy named Earl Rapp, who had been traded to the St. Louis Browns. Somehow Teddy had gotten to him, and he told him about it. Well, he talked about Herman Franks and Hank Schenz sat in the Giant locker room, and they sat at Leo DeRocher's desk, which was, you're too young to remember, but the Polo Grounds, the locker rooms were in dead center field, like 485 feet from home plate. Mm-hmm. And there was an expanse of windows for the Giants, about 7 windows, and they had steps. They were on the right side. They had steps going up and a door and then 7 windows. Well, a visiting team had the same door but 1 window. And the top row had lockers on it, but Leo had his office right there, and he had a desk. And Herman Franks and Hank Schenz sat behind a desk in the shadows with this telescope, which Hank Schenz had been in the U.S. Navy, and he took the telescope home with him. And he said you could see a fly on a chimney 300 feet away. And Herman Franks said, oh, let me see that. And they contrived this scheme where they would sit in Leo's office and they hooked up a buzzer system from Leo's office to the bullpen, which was in right center, and the dugout. And they would buzz. Herman Franks was an ex-catcher, so he could deceive and figure out what signs a catcher was using. Like they'd use first sign after the second two, or a flap sign, which was very easy, or whatever, number sign. You know, you start with a number and you just count. Like they would start with a 3, and it didn't matter what he put down, you just counted 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, fastball. Or you start with a 2 and go 2, 3, 4, and put down a 4, it's 1, it's fastball. So Herman could do that. So they called all the signs. They'd been on a road trip in the West, where we used to take a road trip and visit all the Western cities. And they came home and won 16 in a row, which included 3 games against the Dodgers, like August 10th, 11th, and 12th. And I got beat one of the first game, no, the second game of that series. We lost the first game. Charlie Dressen decided to pitch a guy named Eric Palicki. He gave up 3 runs in the first inning. We lost 3-2. That was a night game. I pitched the next day, and I just had a senior moment.
Well, I want to get back to this for 1 second, but I want to also bring somebody else into the conversation. But first, I have to say this is Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate at WNYC and WNYC.org. While you're trying to remember that moment, I have to bring in a caller because he has something he wants to share with you. This is Dan from Mountain Lakes, New Jersey. Dan, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm on the line.
Okay.
It's a pleasure to talk to Mr. Branko, I'll tell you that, after all these years.
Thank you, Dan.
I was at games 2 and 3, and game 2 was much more favorable outcome as far as I was concerned. I was a rabid Dodger fan.
Right.
And Well, my father had promised to take me to the World Series. I was 9 years old, grade school, whatever grade I was in. He had promised to take me to the World Series, but when the playoffs come up, he says, well, there's a chance they won't get to the World Series, and I will, you know, take you to the playoff games. And something happened with playoff game number one in Ebbets Field, but we did get the games two and three in the Polo Grounds. So anyway, it was very memorable, let's put it that way.
Yeah, memorable. But you know what? Wrong memories for me and you.
Yeah, it's true. I was such a rabid Brooklyn fan. I still remember crying about a spring training game. So I was how you are when you're a 9 year old. But you know, if you love a baseball team, you love a baseball team. And the Dodgers were my love. I drove my father crazy because he was a Yankee fan. And
I still remember
where we sat in that game. We were sitting up in the upper deck behind first base. So you know, it all plays out in my mind. I remember the Polo Grounds very well. One question I had about that game was, I always remember that Rube Walker caught, and I forgot what was wrong with Campanella.
He had a thigh injury.
I think hamstring.
Yeah.
Did you ever think maybe it would have been a different outcome if Campanella was catching, or it was just fate, or?
No. Campy was a better hitter, but Rube was a better catcher.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Rube knew how I wanted to pitch. I rarely shook him off, but I would shake Campy off a lot of times. And Rube gave me that nice low target that I really liked, knee high, right in the middle of the plate.
Yeah.
If I pitched upper in, I looked at his shoulders, you know. That was inside, outside, and his knees for low away. So,
but basically
he might have helped hitting, but, you know, unfortunately, Charlie Dressler made the stupid, grievous mistake. We won the coin toss.
Yeah.
And instead of playing the first game in the Polo Grounds and the next two at home, he did the reverse. I'll never figure it out because last at bats, that's where the home team wins a lot.
Well,
and
here
the Giants won in the last at-bats.
Dan, thanks so much for reliving this important day in Ralph's life. Thanks for calling. We've got a couple of – I want to just take a couple more calls before
say
goodbye, because you've got a lot of fans out there. This is David. David in Manhattan.
Yes, good afternoon, Andy. Good afternoon, Ralph.
Thank you.
A question to Ralph, two-part. First part is regarding the hitters of his time. Other than – Bobby Thompson, what were the hitters that gave you the most difficulty?
Bobby Thompson? He hit 256 against me.
He didn't. Bobby Thompson's
he
a
never
bum.
He never hit a home run off me till they stole the signs.
Yeah. Let's take him out of the mix.
Stan Musial was a tough,
good
tough hitter day in, day out, year after year. And then each year was like a different guy. One year kind of wore me out till I decided I wouldn't throw him any more curveballs. And I threw him fastballs, and I basically got him out pretty good.
Okay, quickly, what was part two?
The other half of the question, of the major hitters of your time, which of those hitters did you have the most success with?
The most success?
Whoa, I'd have to say Wes Westrum and a guy named Virgil Stahlcup. He was a shortstop for Cincinnati. So I think they went 0 for 84 each.
You don't forget those numbers. I've been speaking with Ralph Branca about his career and what it was like to pitch during the dramatic 1951 pennant and playing during baseball's golden age. I wish we had more time, but we do have a great book. His memoir, A Moment in Time, An American Story of Baseball, Heartbreak and Grace, is published by Scribner. Ralph, you're the best. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, I'm sorry I didn't get to talk much about 51 because I know most people are interested in the 51. But the Giants went 37-7 after being 59-51. So even the 27 Yankees couldn't beat the St. Louis Browns that many times in 44 games.
There you go. Well, Ralph Branca will review more of his stats, I guess, and he'll be speaking and signing books next Tuesday at 7 p.m. at Bookends in Ridgewood, New Jersey. And on Wednesday night at 7, he'll be at the Upper East Side Barnes & Noble, and he'll be at Book Review in Huntington, Long Island on Thursday night at 7. For more information on all these events, visit our show page. Up next, WQXR's Elliot Forrest discusses the lighter side of classical music, and WQXR's Classical Comedy Contest. And later on this week's Please Explain, we'll take a look at what happens at the UN General Assembly before, after, and behind the scenes of the speeches from the world leaders. I'm Andy Borowitz, and today for Leonard Lopate, this is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC support comes from the Irondale Center in Brooklyn, presenting dinner theater at Connie's Avant-Garde Restaurant. Irondale presents theater, dance, music, and educational programs to challenge traditional assumptions about art. More information at irondale.org. Silver Hill Hospital, a not-for-profit psychiatric hospital now offering inpatient and residential programs for adolescents. Silver Hill Hospital, restoring mental health since 1931. SilverHillHospital.org. Adelphi University's Performing Arts Center, Garden City, presenting singer-songwriter Simone, September 24th. Simone's repertoire of genres echoes the tradition of her mother, musical pioneer Nina Simone. AUPAC.adelphi.edu.
I don't think that you need money to get into a good public school in New York City. I think you just need to know that there are choices out there and how to navigate those choices.
WNYC brings you award-winning reporting on education all year long. Now we've teamed up with the New York Times to create Schoolbook, an online way to research and compare schools, find the latest news, and communicate with educators and other parents. Visit schoolbook.org.
This is Andy Borowitz sitting in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org. And I just have to reiterate one more time, Bobby Thompson hit only 256 off Ralph Branca. Not impressive at all. Okay, case closed. Now, since everybody seems to be having talent contests these days, WQXR, our sister station, decided there was room for one more, albeit a classical comedy one. Wow. And there's a big payoff. And here to tell us all about this is WQXR's very own Elliot Forrest. Elliot, welcome.
Great to be here.
Now, Elliot, just a little shop talk here. Didn't you recently substitute host for Leonard?
Yeah, I filled in, was it last week already? I can't even remember. Yeah, I fill in for Leonard on occasion. I think it's pretty much either you or me or a couple of other people.
Now, I've got to ask you this because this is just, well, I'll turn off the radio for a moment and we'll just discuss this among ourselves.
Just us girls.
Did they pay you? Because they told me this is just strictly a volunteer job. Did they give you any money or anything like
that? Is that what they
sandwich?
Told you?
That
That's
is what
the
they told me.
Exact truth.
That's the true.
Same
okay.
deal.
Because I felt like kind of a chump coming in here. I'm working very hard.
No, there's a lot
nothing.
Of people who want to do it, and you know, it might lead to something for you.
Okay, cool. That's important. I'm glad we straightened that up. Now, we have to talk about this contest, classical comedy. What's this all about?
This is the WQXR Classical Comedy Contest. We decided that we should be in the business of encouraging the combination of classical music and comedy. As you know, Andy, there's a grand history of this. Not only did some of the composers include a lot of humor in their music, like Haydn's Surprise Symphony and Mozart's A Musical Joke, but, you know, I guess maybe starting with Spike Jones when he was able to turn the Bill Tell Overture into sound effects and make music out of that. And Anna Russell, I don't know if you know who she is.
Yeah, she did all the Wagner opera impersonations.
Yeah, she would like to do a lecture, and she could do, you know, the Ring Cycle's 14 hours, and she could summarize it in 30 minutes.
Right. That's the version I prefer, I think, the 30-minute version.
I think it's the version most people prefer. And then there's Victor Borge, of course, who was, you know, didn't even speak English when he came to this country, but was a great pianist and started to incorporate comedy into his humor and into his performances and eventually became this great comedian and performer as well. Danny Kaye. So there's others, and I'm happy to tell you, but even Adam Sandler incorporating Opera Man.
Sure.
So there's this great tradition of classical music and comedy, and we thought we would try to find the next ones. And here's the deal. The finals, we're going to pick five or six people. Right now we're accepting entries for contestants, but eventually we'll have the finals. The finals will be at Caroline's on Broadway. So
oh, wow.
The finalists get to play Broadway. They get to play one of the premier comedy clubs in the country. And it's also going to be shot as a special for Channel 13 and also be heard on the radio and WQXR. So this is an incredible opportunity for the right performers, for the right group of people who can come forward, enter our contest. We're taking the contestants right now. They can find all the information and the rules at the WQXR.org website.
Okay. And now what are some of the guidelines? Like, how long are these submissions supposed to be?
Well, Well, what we're really asking for from people are up to a 5-minute video that they link to YouTube. And it doesn't have to be like some great performance video. One of our contestants actually did do a Comedy Central special, and he gave us a little piece of that. Somebody else, for example, we have an entrant from a doo-wop group that sings opera. I think they're called doo-opera. And it seems like it was from a cell phone, I think. So it doesn't have to be a great video, but it has to show that you get it, know what we're talking about, and that it's funny. And so you put it on YouTube, give us the link at WQXR.org/comedy, and then some other information like who you are and a little bio, and that's it. So a link to your video and some information, and you're entered.
But it's just to clarify, though, these are funny musical videos, but they have to have some comment or some relationship to classical music. You don't just want funny music. You want something that relates in some way to classical.
That's right, Andy. I mean, I think that we're looking for both professionals and amateurs. You don't necessarily have to be a musician. For mm-hmm. example, if you just do viola jokes and mm-hmm. you just do stand-up, that's great too. You know, perhaps there's a high school or a college choir out there that does funny stuff, or student musicians, maybe a string quartet that does rock music or country. And I'd love to see opera singers sing some TV show tunes, that sort of thing.
Oh, that's a good idea.
So any way that you can sort of mix it up a little, song parodies, pianists, musicians. Here's what I think. I think there's a lot of musicians out there who do stuff at parties.
Uh-huh.
That they go, oh, they would never do this in real life, but it's really funny. And mm-hmm. this is an opportunity to do it on stage.
Well, This sounds like a totally new idea. Has anyone ever done this kind of contest before? Has this been done?
Actually,
somewhere?
This has. I was at another classical radio station here in New York many years ago, and we had done this to great success. And I've had a nice long relationship with Caroline Hirsch, who
runs Caroline.
Caroline's.
Yeah.
And so we
it's a great club.
It's a great club, and we partnered with her, and she greeted this. And when we first proposed it this year, I thought, well, we'll stay away from the New York Comedy Festival, which is a huge citywide comedy festival.
Sure.
She said, no, let's make it part of the New York Comedy Festival.
Well, that's a big
deal.
So
our finals are the 8th, and it's actually part of the New York Comedy Festival.
So, and you're going to winnow it down to how many finalists?
I think it depends upon what the acts are, but I think maybe 5 or 6 finalists will play on the 9th of November, and then one lucky person will be the Classical Comedian of the Year. Well, you know, the big deal for me is they get to play Broadway, they get to be on Channel 13, they're on the radio, there's some exposure, and just come do it because it's fun. But the winner will get a tote bag. It's public radio.
It wouldn't be a public radio contest.
What can I tell you?
Do you have any? Can you give me a little tease about what are some of the submissions you've gotten already?
Well, in addition to Doo Opera, the doo-wop group that sings opera arias, there's a guy is a stand-up comedian, and he literally has a cello strapped to his chest, standing up, doing his set, and he plays the cello, and then he does jokes, and he plays the cello, and he's very good. We also have a violinist by the name of Hugh Fink. I don't know whether you know him, but mm-hmm. he was a writer for Saturday Night Live, and he's a producer of television. He went to school with Joshua Bell and played the violin, still plays the violin, and incorporates the violin into his humor. We did get a submission yesterday from a guy from Israel, and another submission from a guy from Oslo. So this is international, but once again, public radio, we can't really pay to fly people in or put people up. We just hope they enter and then come stay at Andy Borowitz's house if they're a finalist.
That offer no longer applies to anyone who heard it. I just have to make that. I barely have enough room in my house for my family. Well, this is going to be great. This is going to be great. So, thanks for so much for coming in. And not only is this information available on the WQXR .org page, but it's also available on our show page. So, Elliot, thanks so much for coming in. Good luck with the contest.
Happy to be here, Andy. Thank you. Nice to see you.
I've been speaking with Elliot Forrest about WQXR's Classical Comedy Contest. Entries are due before midnight on October 10th, and they should be intentionally funny. I should clarify that, since this is YouTube. For more information about how to enter the contest, visit our show page. Elliot, thanks so much for joining us today.
Nice to see you.